I'm going to talk a little bit about indigeneity of landscapes. And the geographer, Carl Sauer, said we can't form an idea of landscapes except in terms of its time relations as well as its space relations. So it's, a landscape is really both. It's a temporal and a spatial entity, and it's constantly undergoing change. Indigenous peoples have had effects on landscapes even where people thought before that they didn't even have any such effect. And this is how they lost their lands, the Johnson versus McIntosh, which you referred to. And I think that's a fascinating piece that we can continue to refer to that case. And I think it's going to link all the other panelists to some extent, because that's how Native peoples, that's one way that Native peoples lost their lands in the New World. The idea was that they didn't have any land to begin with because they weren't occupying it effectively. Effective meant in a capitalist way. They weren't occupying it as real estate to be bought and sold. They didn't have slavery, so they didn't own people as commodities who could be bought and sold. So when the first people came to the New World, they thought, this is kind of strange, the way that people are using the land. Even if they were farming, even if they had cities, they weren't using the land in the way that had been used, that ways that were familiar to Western capitalist Europe, which was only one little small part of the world. But we are talking about indigenousness or indigeneity. It's hard to define. It's very politically charged. But it has currency and in the United Nations, as we were talking about, international tribunals, as you mentioned before. The World Bank public media self-designated indigenes, non-governmental organizations, human sciences such as anthropology, archaeology, and the law, and so on. And as far as the World Bank and other international agencies are concerned, 200 million people in the world are indigenous. So that means that 5,800,000,000 are not. So not everybody is indigenous. Landscapes are the encounter of people and place with given histories etched into and definitive of matter, including living things. Indigenous people did have effects on living things and on places where they lived in prehistory before the Europeans got there. Before Columbus Day, before there was a Columbus Day. This is what the world was like to Europeans before there was a Columbus Day. It was a Ptolemaic world in which Europe was isolated from the rest. Europe was isolated by an ocean, the Atlantic on one side, and the Indian Ocean, which had a bottom to it. It was like a bowl. They didn't realize that the Indian Ocean went down to the Southern Ocean where Antarctica was. They thought it was closed off by land. And, of course, nobody knew about there was a Cape of Good Hope down here. Africa was about to be endless. So the idea was that Europe was basically isolated, surrounded by this ocean dark, or dark ocean, scary place. And that was the Ptolemaic view of things for 2,000 years since the time of the Ptolemaic cartography of ancient Rome up to the time of the Middle Ages and the Renaissance. But Columbus's voyage changed all that. The irony, of course, is it was lost on Columbus himself. He didn't realize that he discovered a new world. And that's this. With the new world, there were new oceans. There are new continents. So before that, there had only been one continent and one ocean. After Columbus, there were oceans and continents and others. And these others are the people that today we call indigenous. But the lands they occupied were, in Roman law and in the law of the time, they came to be called terra nullius, which means lands of nobody, because, as you just said in your introduction, Professor Woods, Australia fell under this category, Africa fell under this category, Micronesia fell under this category. All the places where European colonization went fell under this category because these lands were open to the colonists and the colonizers as lands that could be taken, even if they had been transformed by human activity in prehistory, such as even Micronesia. They were thought that these were natural formations. In fact, the ridge tops on Palau in Micronesia, according to the archaeologist Rainbird, are in fact sculpted landscapes, as is much of the island's area. Much of West Africa has been shown to be, in terms of the forests, cultural forests. These islands of forest here are not relics of the Pleistocene, as has been thought, but rather are forests that were planted by the native people, such as the Mende and others who lived there over centuries. The idea that the people should be taken out of those forests to protect the forests and the biota, is something of a contradiction in terms, because in fact it was the people and their ancestors over the long term who created those forests to begin with. Amazonia itself, as I and others have argued, consists in part of forests that have been made by peoples in ancient times, what I've called cultural forests, others call them anthropogenic forests. One such forest can be found in Bolivia. You talked about Bolivia. In the eastern Bolivian Amazon, in the basin of the Mamoré River, which drains into the Amazon, there's a vast system of mounds and causeways across an area the size of Iowa that is two-thirds wetland savanna. But the high ground, such as the mound like this, a place called Ibibate, which would have looked like this at about AD 1500, a mound occupied by thousands of people, today is covered in forest, a forest that would not be there had it not been for the fact that people built this mound, which is today 63 feet high. This is what it looks like on Google Earth. It consists, in addition, of 65 species of trees, whereas the savanna itself only has 18 species of vascular plants, all told. Some of these include important fruit trees, and I listed some of these here. This is a causeway coming out from the mound complex that is today occupied by an indigenous people known as the Siriono. That causeway was built in ancient times by native peoples across the wetland savanna to connect this mound to other mounds. And these are technologies that are lost, no longer practiced today, that are only known through research that we do today, as are technologies lost from Marajo Island, the mouth of the Amazon, an island the size of Switzerland, where we also have similar mounds that were used for similar purposes to accommodate poor drainage, where people can, in fact, live where that in the past they were unable to live otherwise. It has probably always had a certain other market appeal. Those places where indigenous people lived, but they were deprived of these lands by European colonization because they did not occupy them in the way that Europeans used the land as real estate to be bought and sold, to be taken, to be occupied, to be fenced in, and used in ways that were completely alien to the indigenous peoples that had different ways of using and occupying the land. Not as domicilium vacuum, which is the way they were seen, as empty lands. That's United States law, by the way. And so indigenous peoples themselves are perceived either as cheap labor or as illegitimate occupants of these landscapes. That goes for Australia, as you said, Africa, and the New World. Today, these landscapes and their indigenous heritages are being lost to the fait accompli of what is called gradual encroachment. What must be done? We need to guarantee the freedom of access by indigenous peoples to the landscapes of their ancestors, which are rich in flora and fauna also, and protection to these landscapes before the combined fait accompli of gradual encroachment by globalization and modernization and illegal activities such as logging, some oil prospecting, and so on, of landscape transformation by outside methods become inescapable realities. Thank you.